On the Basketball Manitoba podcast, we have Joel Corson. Joel played his high school basketball at Steinbeck Regional High School. He then went on to play at Providence College for 3 seasons. During his playing career, he received numerous awards, including MCAC All-Conference Award and was the NCCAA All-Conference Honorable Mention. His passion for basketball didn't stop. After he finished playing, he went on to become the assistant coach of the Providence women's basketball team for 1 year. From there, he took over as head coach, a role he's now held for 12 years. Under his leadership, the team has achieved numerous milestones, including winning the NIAC Championship in 2019, where he was named NIAC Coach of the Year. Additionally, he was named MCAC Coach of the Year in 2023. This season, he achieved a personal milestone of winning his 100th game as a head coach, with an impressive 63 wins and 44 losses since 2018. Joel, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Darcy. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, man. So 2023 Coach of the Year, obviously that's this year. Right. tell me a little bit about the year, because this is the first time you won that award, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it's the first time. So, I mean, that maybe that says something. If I've been here for 12 years and I've won it once. This was a unique season for a lot of reasons. I've got lots to talk about because it's more fresh and I don't have the best memory. So, it was a unique year. I mean, we've been coming back from the pandemic for 2 seasons now. Last year was an abbreviated year. We basically just played in Manitoba and, we finally got back to playing over the border this year. So it was a full season. I think we had almost 30 games. I was telling you earlier, when we booked this season, we couldn't travel or the American teams couldn't travel to us. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we had to agree that basically we played our whole season on the road. So I was gone like every other weekend since the start of the year. I think I've had like 8 home games this year.
That's crazy.
So it was definitely the longest grind of a season in the 12 years that I've been here. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying you earned that Coach of the Year?
Yeah. Sure.
Well, because to be fair, so you know, people who don't know, and you're talking about the NIAC team specifically in this case, for the most part, for the league play.
Yeah, NIAC, yeah. NCCAA as well. Yeah.
So, and I think that's the thing that, you know, a lot of people don't understand. So when I say Providence College, either you know it intimately, like, oh, I know Providence, or like, you're like, I've never heard of it. Right. And so, you know, back when I was coming out of high school, I got a letter from Providence College. I didn't know where Providence College was. And I had Providence College legend, Graham Bodner on the podcast. And I told him this story and he's like, yeah, it's like, I didn't know who it was either. Right. And, interestingly enough, when we were getting you on the podcast and I was reflecting, I think, you know, we've done like 40 something interviews, and I think we've literally interviewed like 5 or more former Prov alumni. So it's interesting because for a school that most people don't know about, the people that go and play there, they give back to the community and stay involved in basketball, in a way that I think, is maybe an expression of, you know, how meaningful the experience is for the people who end up going to Providence, right? Because I speak to, you know, there's people I know in addition to the people who I've interviewed, and they speak very highly of their memories there, their time there. And so it's an interesting place. It's somewhat of an anomaly, I would say, being that like, there's like, again, people like yourself and other people in the community, but before, don't really know much about the school, right? So I just thought it's a very interesting reflection. I got to ask you, man, like, I know we're going to get into this later on, but you know, you're a coach, you're recruiting. So do you experience that exact thing that I'm talking about? You're like, hey, come to this school. Except before you answer the question, I mean, Graham Bodner literally told me his story of how he got there. And someone just said, hey, there's this school like out in Otterburn, and they, you know, they have a college team and you can go play there. And he was like, what? I never heard of this. And this is a guy, as we both know, Graham, he's a basketball diehard. So you'd think if anyone would know, it would be him, right? So I digress. But in saying that, do you experience some of these same things when you're approaching locals to come play at Providence?
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Like the fact that you've had 5 people on this show that are in the basketball community who are Providence alumni, and people in the small community of basketball Manitoba still don't know a lot about us. Maybe that says we need to be talking a little bit more about it, spreading the word. So interviewing me in this podcast is really great. I hope people remember the name, at least Providence. I run into that all the time. There's definitely a growing knowledge. And I think part of that is probably a little bit of a growing awareness of MCAC. Mm-hmm. It's not that old. It hasn't been around that long, really.
No.
And only in the last years has it really become a little bit more well-known, probably partly because it's gone CCAA with volleyball and soccer. So mm-hmm. we have a little bit more national recognition. So that brings awareness to our schools. I run into it all the time, and it's like disappointing, but then on the other hand, it's like, hey, I can tell you about this gem in the Southeast that
exactly. that it's like a hidden gem. It really is. Like, again, and like I said, like, I don't have to say this. You just said it. And I think it might even be more than five people, to be honest with you. But like the impact that it has on people's lives again. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that, but the fact that it is just kind of out there and people have to, like, you're almost insulated in this micro community. I think that's a big part of it. And there's obviously other reasons as well, but, like you said, it's almost like maybe you don't want to tell everyone, like, I don't know, interesting. I just thought that was an interesting, cause again, I just thought of it. I was like, yeah, you know what? There's like, I think Prov, as far as its impact on the basketball community, punches way above its weight for the people who do go there, right? Even though it's not well known, like, the people tend to be people who give back and are involved in the basketball community. So I think, that's a big plug right there. there's your plug. We're doing some recruiting for you right now. Go check out Providence, check them out. So, but I want to jump into your story, man, because, we were talking a little bit before. You said, I asked you, I'm like, you know, did you grow up in Steinbeck? You're like, yeah, grew up in Steinbeck. You're a Steinbeck guy. Otterburn is not Steinbeck, but that region of the province, you're a small town guy. You ended up going to Providence and now you're coaching at Providence. But what I really want to do is start at the beginning and kind of find out what your first memories of basketball were. How did you get started? Where did you play? All those questions. So yeah, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. I started following basketball because my dad played basketball. My dad was from California. He met my mom in the States at Bible College, and she was from here. So they got married and moved up here, and he started working in ministry up here. While he was working in ministry, he started studying at Providence, and he played for Providence. Kid, like, I was too little to see him play at Providence, but after he had graduated from Providence, he continued working for the same organization. But they lived in Steinbeck, and back in the day, Steinbeck Bible College had basketball. So, and the rules were a little bit more, non-existent. So
yeah, a little more fluid. It's like, oh, I don't know. What's the rule today?
Yeah. Well, so they needed a coach and they also needed players. So he was the player coach for a handful of seasons at nice. SBC. And so I grew up as a little kid going to SBC and watching my dad play basketball there. And then, you know, as I grew up, I played everything. I played, you know, hockey, soccer, basketball. I just liked sports. And, and then my dad, he started like the only pickup game in Steinbeck. So it was Thursday night basketball, and we're talking basketball Manitoba is a small community. Basketball in Steinbeck at that time was like the tiniest community, and so I basically, it seemed like I knew everybody in Steinbeck who played basketball, and I kind of grew up following that and going to that. So then I started playing at a younger age. My dad coached me in grade 7, and then my brother, who's 8 years older than me, he went to Providence. He played 4 years. He played with Graham Bodner. He played with Tim Friesen some of those guys. And so I kind of, in my like developmental years where most kids are picking what sport they want to, you know, focus on. And I'm living in Steinbeck, which is like the volleyball capital of Manitoba.
I was going to say, yeah.
and so I've got, you know, I've got all those influences, but then I get to go watch my brother play college basketball at Providence. Mm. So we'd go out to as many home games as we could and watch that. And, that, you know, so by the way, getting to Providence was, like an anomaly because I knew about it.
Yes.
So I was a little bit homegrown, and that was kind of how I fell in love with basketball. And you wanted to know, like, where did I play? Like, you've probably been to Steinbeck. There's an outdoor court downtown. I grew up playing basketball with, like, Eric Sung,
Colton Gribba.
Yeah. Cam Friesen, those guys.
Yeah.
Probably different guys that you played senior men's with over the years. So I grew up playing there. We were like the one group of high school kids that kind of moved up together that didn't really care much about volleyball. So we kind of stood out because every above us, below us, they were all volleyball players. And we were the team that kind of sucked at volleyball, but we kept going up. And I'm a couple years behind Sung. So when he was still in high school, we played a lot together, but then, you know, he ended up going to Providence. And so I didn't see him as much, but yeah, that was kind of my growing up years.
So when you were in high school, I'm guessing you were, you know, you're how tall are you again? Just so everyone knows.
Now I'm 6'7".
You're 6'7". So in high school, were you like 6'4"? Like, did you grow after? Yeah. Like, I mean, obviously you were growing through high school, but you were always tall, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was always tall. Like, I think I was 6'4" in grade 12. Like, I couldn't dunk in grade 12. I was terrible. you know, I was just the tall guy on an OK team, right?
Yeah.
You know, believe it or not, now as I'm thinking back, I didn't even play grade 12 basketball. I played up until grade 11.
Yeah.
And then like, I wasn't a high school type person. It wasn't my thing. But I also played volleyball along the way.
I was just going to ask you that. Did you play volleyball?
I think I was better at volleyball than basketball.
Really?
In high school. I played grade 12 volleyball, and then I graduated at Christmas. And I had the option to play basketball, but I just like, I didn't like school, which is crazy that I ended up going to college. I just hated school. so I graduated and I left and I didn't play grade 12. Whereas like all of my teammates graduated and like half of them went to Providence the next year.
Yeah. Yeah. So then did you go straight to Providence or did you like sit out some years? Like, cause you didn't play basketball in grade 12. Like tell us that. Like,
yeah, so I didn't play basketball in grade 12. I took the year off. My friends like Cam, Colton, Kanya, they all went to Providence. They had been going to the sports camps for years and kind of built a relationship with Tim Friesen. He wasn't the coach at the time, but he was the AD there. And they all went to Providence right out of high school. I took the year off. When I graduated, I went, so my dad was a director at Red Rock Bible Camp. And so that was kind of like my life growing up. He was there for like 30 years. And, I graduated and I went to work there. The unique thing about Red Rock is that they've got a pretty nice court and, and they have a really athletic staff every summer. Nice. So I would play most of my basketball outside of playing at this downtown court in Steinbeck was playing basketball and beach volleyball at camp every summer. And, and so when I graduated, I moved there, I worked there and then summer would come around and I'd play pickup. And then I went and I'd watch my former teammates play at Providence that next year. And, you know, nice. I'm watching them and I thought like, my basketball is done. Like, I don't really care about it anymore. I'm going to move on with life. There's no way I'm going to school, but I'm watching them. And I went to probably like a dozen games. They clearly had more home games than I do now, but, I'd go and I'd watch and it started to kind of kill me that I wasn't there playing with them. And so I played pickup ball. And then the next summer came and, I had already kind of planned that I was going to go to Providence. I was going to play there. So I played pickup ball with some pretty good players in the summer at camp. And then I came out and I went to Providence and, I mean, I was 6'7" at that point. So they took me.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, yeah. He's pretty tall. he knows how to play. Let's go.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. Cause I think, I believe I know I was at CMU, but I guess I was there for like, I don't know if it was all 3 years that you played. I know for some of the years. So like I was coaching against you playing.
Right.
But I just don't know if it was like after I started or like, I don't remember the timing of it all.
Yeah.
But I definitely remember you as a player. Okay. So when you get there, your friends are still playing, like Colton, all those guys, Kanya, Friesen, Cam Friesen, they're all playing there still.
Yeah. About half of them stayed. Cam, okay. Kanya left. Cam and Colton were there for sure.
Okay. Nice. Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Cool. So, you know, I always like to ask about mentors, and obviously it seems like your dad was a huge mentor. You also mentioned your older brother played at Providence. Were there any other people kind of, you know, whether it be when you were in high school or, I mean, you had mentioned, you know, the Red Rock Bible Camp there with some good athletes, some people who kind of encouraged you to keep going with basketball. You obviously loved playing, so it wasn't necessarily that, but I think it's really important. You know, we all have people in our lives who are kind of like giving us the nudge. Hey, go try doing that. So were there any people in your life, you know, whether it had been early high school, later on after you graduated, or even up until while you were at Providence, that were really just influential in kind of keeping you in basketball? Because now you're coaching. So clearly there was people there that were like guiding you a little bit, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. We'll say outside of my dad and my brother. Oddly enough, the connection to Graham Bodner started pretty early. He hangs around. He's in the community. Oh, he's at Providence. He definitely
hangs around.
So
understatement of the year.
Yeah. So like I said, he played with my brother. So yeah. I had seen this guy. He was my brother's friend. He's not 8 years older, but my brother's 8 years older than me. So that gap's big enough that I didn't think we would become friends, but he hangs around. So he's at Providence. He's there at the start. I mean, he was, I think in his podcast, he said he was an assistant coach.
Yes.
But he forgot to say he was my assistant coach my first year at Providence.
Oh.
And he also played for Booth. So he's the assistant coach.
Yeah.
And then the one game we play Booth, he leaves our bench and goes in and puts on Booth's jersey and then torches us. So, he's around. He built a relationship with me from, you know, kind of day one that I got there. Mm-hmm. And, I would say probably in for sure in basketball terms and, you know, probably to some extent in life, he's probably one of the people that I look up to the most. You know, like over the years, I've had him come out and spend time with my team, you know, lead some practices and just try to kind of rub off who he is on my team. Cause he brings so much enthusiasm for the game, dedication, passion, just the way that he talks about his experience and kind of saying like, this is the pinnacle. Today is the pinnacle of my basketball career every day. You want him around, right? So he'd come out, he'd lead some sessions with my team, and over the time we correspond back and forth. Like I'm pretty much every tournament he's emailing me every day, like you know, let's talk about the game, let's talk about the next game, that sort of thing. And outside of him, I mean, I had Mitch Katakutin coach me my first year at Prov. Juan Larios coached me the next 2 years at Prov. They were definitely like big people in my life. Then I don't see them, either of them, really anymore. But at the time, they were the best coaches that I had ever had. Right. Mm-hmm. And how I got into coaching, Juan, at some point in my senior year, he told me, probably in passing on the bus or something, he said, you know, I think you'd make a really good coach. And that kind of stuck with me. And when I graduated, I didn't feel like it was done. When I graduated, I felt like I was done being a student. And I wanted to get into the occupation field that I had studied. And so like I came to Providence, took the youth leadership program like Graham. My plan was I was either going to get into camp ministry like my dad, like a lot of people do, they follow their parents' footsteps and careers, or I was going to be a youth pastor at a church somewhere. But I started applying after college, and these places, they take forever to get back to you. And so like, as you're waiting, I gotta start paying off my loans. So I get a summer job. I'm working in Steinbeck at the Mennonite Heritage Museum, feeding the goats. And, and I get a call from Providence and they're like, well, you're an enthusiastic guy. We'd like you to be a student recruiter. So you want to come work for us? Oh, meanwhile, nice. I'm still waiting to hear back from these churches that I was intending on working for. So I say, yeah, like, I'm not planning on feeding goats forever. So I come in, I work at Providence, but, I would say probably it was like the day after, I decided that I was going to go work at Providence. I gave Patty Parker a call and I said, you know, Patty, I'm going to come back and work at Providence next year, but I'm not done with basketball. Would you be interested in assistant coach? And as I've heard from basically everybody coaching university in Manitoba, getting assistant coaches seems like the hardest thing to do.
So yeah, no kidding. She's like,
absolutely, I'll take you.
Yeah.
I'm on the moon thinking like, hey, I just got my first coaching gig.
yeah.
So yeah, that's how I got into coaching. Yeah.
Wow. So like before that, did you do any like community level coaching or anything? Or was it just like, boom, here you are. It's right into it. Wow. Wow. And it's interesting too, because you had said like hey, I want maybe youth pastor and stuff like that. And now you're getting to work in the school that you obviously played at, have a strong family connection to. And in a way, you still get to affect youth. We'll call them youth or adults, but in a very similar way, in a very similar setting. So it's kind of probably somewhat of the best of both worlds in that regard.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when I got hired, I did that student recruiting for a season. At the end of that season, Patty had gotten into a master's program and had to leave the school. And so, I don't know, shortly after Christmas, Scott approached me and said, hey, like, Patty recommends you. We think you do great. I know you're incredibly green, but like, we'll give you room to grow into this. We'd like you to take over and work in athletics full time. And then paired with coaching the women's basketball team, we want you to run our summer sports camps. And so I graduated thinking I was either going to be in camp ministry or I was going to be a pastor. And then I end up at Providence and they want me to like manage a basketball team and run their summer sports camp. So it seemed like everything kind of paired with my passions. So like a fool would say no. So of course, like I take it and, or maybe a fool takes it because it was not easy.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
with my coaching experience, it was very, very hard. But yeah, I took it and I jumped right in. And it was kind of, now I'll get into what it was like when I started. Like Graham had coached the women's team for 2 years. I thought it was three, but I guess it was two. And then they kind of had like, he had an amazing team. They made the NCCA regional final twice. That was a first. I think they had two NIAC championships and one or two MCAC championships. I can't remember, but they were really good. He had some excellent players. Heather Bowie went on to U of W, was there. And then he left. I think he went to Richer. He got a great career opportunity and left. And so they kind of went into a rebuilding year and they ended up with a couple of faculty members, I think, coaching the team because it was short notice. And so a lot of the players left and it was, it began kind of this rebuild. Patty came in and I want to say Patty was here for 3 years and she was kind of like slowly building the program back up. But it's hard. It's really hard to do that in a short amount of time. And when she left, some players had also left. And so when I took over, I didn't have a lot of returning players. We had actually in that year that I was the assistant coach, we weren't very good. Patty was able to convince her twin sister, Christine, to come back and play second semester, which was wild. And so we went into the MCAC championships, like, fourth place, and we're playing U of W, and somehow we pull off the Cinderella story and upset U of W. And
you're an assistant or in your first year as a head coach?
This is my assistant year.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah, so we had lost to the College Westman by 50 like four or five times, and then we go into that first round game and we somehow upset them. And then lose to Jay at Red River in the finals. And then Christine leaves because she's only there for a semester. A couple other kids graduate and move on. And then I take over this program and I've got a couple kids coming back, but it's kind of a rebuild and I don't know what I'm doing. I'm in my first year as a head coach. I don't know how to recruit. Nobody knows me in Manitoba. Specifically not like in the women's basketball realm at all. And it's like, figure it out. And nobody knows Providence. So I had a lot of things stacked against me to start. And it took a long time. And I would say probably at least my first 5 years, the biggest question I was trying to answer was like, what do I want to be as a coach? What kind of program do I want to have? Yeah. And I thought that there were like some key things that they were like, I don't know, like cheat codes to being a good coach and starting a program. And like, if I could figure out these things that everybody else is doing, all of a sudden I can be as successful as like Jay has been at Red River or Joe now is at CMU. And like, it took a while to realize that it's not a couple really big things. It's all the little things that you do, all the habits that you create as a coach that you create with your players. And it took like 5 years to start to like understand these things and realize also that, that everybody's figuring it out. Everybody does it their own way. Most people are sitting in their like coaching class or, you know, thinking like, man, I don't know what I'm doing. I wouldn't do it that way. I haven't heard of that before.
That's so true.
And then you start to realize, oh wait, there's a lot of different ways of doing this, and I can kind of create my own way and figure out what my values are and what I want my program to look like, and then kind of build it that way. And then, you know, I think I said I saw was it Jay Wright had quoted saying something like systems work. You just need to get your people to buy into your systems. Like, there's lots of systems. There's lots of ways to do it. Need to get buy-in, and so it took a while, which kind of reflects why it took me so long to get 100 career wins. But once we got to that point, I realized I needed to get buy-in, and I needed to get retention, and I needed to build a team of veteran players, and I needed to figure out like, where do I recruit? And I started with looking at Winnipeg and thinking like, okay, the most of the 4A kids are in Winnipeg. I need to get in at the Glenlawns, get in at the FRCs, you know. And then I realized, wait a second, there's a lot of diamonds in the rough around Manitoba that wherever they go to school, they have to move. And they're probably coming from a smaller environment that coming to Providence would be a really nice fit. So I started looking around and I pulled a kid from Sprague, Caitlin Thiessen, who was, I think she won provincials 3 or 4 times in a row. Like, she won every provincial championship that she played in. and so diamond in the rough. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I found a kid from Vita, Megan Weeb, who again, like, you'd never guess watching her play where she was from. Right. And so I just kind of went around and like Glenbro, I pulled 2 kids from Glenbro that were on my NIAC championship team. And, you know, it's funny, cause then as I'm talking to some of these other kids from Winnipeg, I'm like, yeah, I got these 2 girls from Glenbro, and they're kind of like, where, or Vita, or, you know,
I don't even know where Vita is. I've never heard of it,
but there's kids out there.
Of course,
kids out there. And so I need to go and I need to find these kids and I need to bring them here. And I started doing that. And then I was able to get buy-in from these kids and they stayed their whole careers. And because we were able to keep them so long, we were able to develop them the way that we wanted to play the game. And I knew that I wasn't probably going to get kids that were necessarily college ready with experience because they were from smaller schools that just, you know, they didn't play necessarily the same club ball or have the same influences in their life. coaching wise. And so it was going to take development and then having veterans. And so we did it kind of like the mid-major way in the States and not, you know, not the Duke way. And it took time. So we end up getting this, getting to this point where we win this NIAC championship, which was like, you know, I thought winning, I would, the feelings that I would have winning would be like, I don't know, like I'd be jumping up and down or like losing my mind or something. And then it's funny, Pierre, our men's coach, was watching the game. He was there and he's like, yeah, your team won. And you just kind of stood there like clapping.
Mild mannered. Like, yeah, like, I guess.
Yeah, it was really amazing. It was a huge milestone, but it was like, this didn't change my life ultimately, but we finally got to that point. It was amazing. And then the next year, we returned a lot of the team. We made it back to the NIAC championship game. We were playing CMU in the NIAC championship game in this small town in the States near Bemidji, and went to overtime and ended up losing by one in overtime. So that was kind of, that was disappointing. Because, you know, we had built something, and I mean, it's disappointing. You lose by one. Right. But then probably the hardest thing was finally feeling like I had built a program, and we were going to be moving forward. Cause I think I had everybody on that team that lost by one. I had everybody coming back the next year, and then a pandemic comes.
I was going to say, I feel like, pandemic year.
Are you kidding me? I've put so much time into like figuring this out. How do I build a program? And then a pandemic comes. And like, I mean, how it impacts basketball is one thing. And that's like, that's too bad. I don't want to make light of it. Like it has incredible devastating effects in so many ways. But as far as our program goes, it was like, okay, restart. And at Providence, it's not like, it's a private education. It's a little bit more expensive. So kids weren't able to financially go and use the like exemption year and get another year of eligibility. Like I can't afford it. So I didn't get the benefit of kids coming that year, training in awkward non-contact ways. And then the next year, them coming back and ended up getting any 5-year players out of it. So it just ended up meaning like I started to slowly kind of graduate the kids that had helped kind of get the program to where it was. And kind of slowly try to figure out, okay, coming out of a pandemic, can we have the same identity that we had before? Do we have to reinvent ourselves? What does that look like? And also during the pandemic, not being able to coach in the same ways that we were before. I'm like jumping over every opportunity I can to get PD on Zoom calls, because like when you're coaching a full season, that's another thing. Like how do you, all of the PD stuff is during my season. I can't, it's next to impossible to go to this clinic or this clinic because I'm on the road, I'm in the States somewhere. But then finally during this time, it's all shut down. And so I'm embracing, hey, let's take as many Basketball Canada clinics as I can.
Yeah.
So anyways, that was a lot there.
No, it's awesome, man. Like again, like it's you. I don't know this stuff either. So again, you're just kind of giving us that perspective and framing everything. One question I want to ask you is: we mentioned a little bit, you know, early on in your coaching, you're like, I don't know what I'm doing. This is new to me. You went from an assistant coach, never coaching, by the way, not even like a community thing. Assistant coaching, like, look, we want you to take it all, and you're like, okay, cool, I'm going to do that. But you mentioned kind of when you were explaining the whole kind of development and the origin story and how how you developed to this point now, you mentioned some of your values, right? And you talked about systems and values, right? And so kind of wanted to, you know, if you could share, you know, big picture, obviously we don't have to get into the nitty gritty of it, but some of those values, philosophies and systems that you put in place and now are part of your program there at Prov that maybe didn't exist, 100% didn't exist when you started, but now are in place and have kind of fostered some of that success.
Yeah. I think one of the first things that comes to mind was I want to say it was after we won that NIAC championship, and I'm debriefing this with Graham And Graham says, now there's a difference. It's, you're not just coaching a basketball team. Now it's a program.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of things at Prov have changed over time. Like, you know, when Graham played, when I played, coaches were part-time. They were driving and they had other jobs.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't, you know, they couldn't put the time and effort into making a program.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the coaches were here for 3 years and then they were kind of maxed out and they had to leave because it's like a lot of them have families. And so you're juggling like a full-time job, driving for to sure. Otterburn, coaching these ridiculous road trips and then having a family. So it's kind of impossible, but I was fortunate enough that I got a full-time job. And even though it wasn't full-time coaching, I had so much other stuff going on. I was here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could shape things a little bit different and more intentionally. And I think a sign of a program is retention.
Mm.
When you can get kids to keep coming back and have large graduating classes, that's a sign of a program because people seem to be buying into what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And part of that I think is coach consistency. And so we were seeing this, our coaches would leave after 3 years, kids would graduate or kids would just like transfer because,
mm-hmm.
You know, maybe they really liked that coach, but it wasn't a program. And it was at that point where, yeah, okay, we've built something more sustainable here. And then like values and the little things along the way. I mean, I learned in my schooling here, like, don't try to reinvent the wheel, steal as much information from people that have done it before. Mm-hmm. Like you're wasting precious time if you're trying to just like reinvent everything. And so like, I'm trying to pull stuff from anybody and everybody. I think you can learn from anybody. And we go down to, we get invited to go down to Mayville State every year. Mm-hmm. And I did this as a player. We went down to NDSCS. This is maybe the funny story if you want.
Let's hear it.
So I'm a first year player. And so first year player specifically here, you don't know who you're playing. You don't know where you're going. You just get on the bus or in the van and you drive and you show up and you play. So most of my friends, I'm one of two first years on the team. Me and Tim Ewart from MBCI, we're the only first years on the team. Right. And, we get in the vehicle and we're heading to this tournament down. I don't even know where it was in the States, but we play our first game and it's like a 20-point game and it feels okay. But we go and we watch who we're going to play the next day. And we show up at this like monstrous facility, bigger than U of W. It's got a jumbotron. They've got a track. Yeah. Their bleachers are like, they roll them back for like indoor track and whatever, like it's mm-hmm. enormous. And I have to get taped before the game. So I get taken to this back room and I'm sitting on the bed waiting for the trainer to come and tape me. And a couple guys on the team that I'm playing against are sitting there getting taped. And it's funny. They're asking me like, hey, Providence, like they don't know who we are either. So they're like, who are you? Like, what are you? D2? I'm like, okay, let me lay this out for you. Here's there's D1, there's D2, there's and then you guys, and then and us. And he looks at me and he's like, we're gonna murder you.
hold on. Did he actually say this?
He said, or did he just give you the look? We're gonna murder you. I'm like, all right, put my head down, get taped. I go back out, go to the locker room. I tell a couple guys about my experience and they're like, oh yeah, we've been here before. We know how this is going to go. And I'm like, why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you tell me what we were getting ourselves into? As we're walking out from the locker room, they've got like ropes roping off the fans. Their fans know what's about to happen.
Mm-hmm.
They're yelling at us. They're taunting us. We come out on the court. And I don't remember the exact score, but I'm going to say the final score was like 97, 20. So I don't know. Like No, it was worse than that. I think we lost by like 95 points. It was unbelievable. They had the guy I'm guarding transfers. This is a junior college. So yeah. These are guys that just didn't have the grades to get in D1s. So they go there, get the grades up, and then they hope for their opportunity. Well, the guy I'm guarding the next year, he's playing for Tennessee in March Madness. I'm from Steinbeck. What was I supposed to do against this guy? The point guard Colton says he's got a better memory than this than I do. He's like, they threw an alley-oop to the point guard and he back rimmed it over me. And and we go into halftime and I don't know, we're down 40. And I remember this is funny because I'm sure Mitch remembers this differently, but I just remember we come into the locker room and Mitch is like giving us the gears, yelling at us, like, we can be like, coach, how much better can we be in this situation? And we lose by 90 some points. And like that was an eye-opening experience, but you find out like, hey, they paid for us to come down.
Yeah.
They wanted to put on a highlight reel. So anyways, I say all that, a few years into coaching, I get this email from Mayville State. He tells me, hey, you know, we'll cover this much cash, hotels, whatever, for you to come down. Like, there's not a chance that I'm putting my team through this. That was the worst experience of my life. But I asked them and they're like, well, yeah, another trip. That'll be fun. We'll do it. So sure enough, we go do it. Virtually the same outcome. It's miserable. We get home and basically I walk into my office and I've got an email from him saying, hey, we'll take you back next year. Like, sure you will. Sure. Like, there's not a chance, but I'll ask my players. And they're all like, yeah, 100% we're going back and we're not going to lose by 75 next year. We're going to go back. So we go back and we've been going back every year since other than the pandemic. And I realized, hey, yeah, this team's better than me. They're not in my league. I need to learn as much as I can from this guy. So mm-hmm. I go mm-hmm. and every time I go down, I sit with him, I pick his brain. I try to, you know, pick up as much as I can from this guy because he's running a really successful program.
Yeah.
You know, they're in championship games every year. This is NAIA. And so I'm learning from him and I've picked up a lot of things from him. Like it never really crossed my mind that this was like, I don't know, years ago, they would scrimmage against a boys team. They would basically like recruit from the students, a boys team. Mm-hmm. They'd scrimmage mm-hmm. against that, scrimmage against them a few times a week. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I brought that back and I'm like, well, at times, you know, my roster wasn't huge and we get a couple injuries and we're not able to scrimmage in practice. So mm-hmm. I put that down. So I started bringing in a team of guys that we were practicing against.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of the reason was one of the questions I asked him was, what is the biggest challenge that you face? And he said, intensity in practice. Like that's probably the biggest question that every coach is asking. How do I create game-like intensity in practice every day? Mm-hmm. And that was one thing that he did. He brought in this team. And so we started doing that. Anyways, you asked about like the values and the culture and stuff. And so I pick up information from him. You know, I'm pick up some from John Wooden, you know, putting his socks on and tying his shoes right and starting with the littlest things. So I figured, you know, whether like it's necessarily like the best thing to do, it creates a level of like togetherness and discipline. So we were really intentional about our pregame warmup. We were going to, I was going to hold them to being like really, really, really precise. And we were going to do our like dynamic warmup together in unison, not cutting corners. We were going to pay close attention to like little details like that. I started caring about like the warm-up shirts that we wore, like, and mm-hmm. now I see teams and one kid's wearing like last year's model and I'm like, I can't be in the gym anymore. And then you see the kid, he's wearing like his high school shirt. I'm like, you're cut. You're not on my team anymore. You know, or like somebody's wearing headphones in team warm-up and I'm like, I just can't. And so I started kind of creating these habits in my players that, you know, we match to a T. You will not be caught with headphones in during team warm up, that kind of stuff. And just like those little things. And it started with that. It started with just little things. What you do with your seniors, your grads, like, you know, how we recognize them at the end of the year. We started little traditions. Like, when I was a player, I experienced this after the last game. You don't really debrief the game. You just give the floor to the seniors. They talk, they share, it's their kind of like moment, their teary spotlight. You know, I get gifts for my players who graduate and give it to them. Like, just, it's all little things, but it creates a program and it creates a culture. And then like when we're recruiting, we're looking for really, you know, unique, specific things that aren't necessarily just basketball skills. And I know every coach is doing this, but being Providence and Otterburn, there's also other specific little things that we're looking for. Sure. And those things have changed over time. And I'd love to talk about like what we're doing now at some point, because it's like drastically different outside the box. But yeah, it was those little things that we kind of installed over time that created this feeling like this is a bigger thing. It's bigger than just like high school. It's big, you know, it's bigger than what the perception is of Providence and people care. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we're winning. It did come to 2019 and 2020 where we were like close to 20 wins a season. But it took a long time to get there, and it's not a guarantee that we're going to win, but it is a guarantee that we're going to have a culture and we're going to be a program.
Well, it's interesting. And you saying all that, when you're telling the story about how, when you won the NIAC and you're just like, good job. Like, you weren't, you know, going crazy or anything like that. But I think that speaks to kind of the process wherein, like, you know, it's less about that destination of like, you know, the outcome is, well, we're likely going to win at some point. That's the potential outcome. There's no guarantee there. But the one thing that you can guarantee is, like you said, the values, the little things that you do, you know, make sure people were doing the same warm up, all these little tiny things. And I think that's, if you can find the glory in that, right? I think that's where what you end up being like you're happy. And I'm sure later on, maybe hit you like, hey, we won that. But I think that is kind of a representation, that moment of being kind of like, yeah, you know what, we did this, because you weren't surprised. You're like, yeah, good job. Like, you know, and so I think that's kind of what, you know, what I, when you tell me everything you've told me with the stories and all that, it kind of connects to that moment a little bit. I don't know if that makes any sense, but that's kind of how it seems to me a little bit.
Yeah. Like the championship in itself was creating a program, not getting a trophy.
There you go. Perfect. Yeah. Exactly. Perfectly said.
Yeah.
So you talked about the Mayville thing. I was CMU, obviously went down there and got smacked a bunch of times as well. So I know how that goes, but that's definitely probably your funniest story, but I want to kind of ask you a different story about maybe your most memorable story. And again, I know, you know, the championship was, maybe that's memorable. It wasn't, you weren't going crazy or anything, but is there a story or stories or moments, or even just lessons that you've learned that stand out as being absolutely memorable, kind of in your journey up to this point?
Yeah. The first game that comes to mind, because I think sometimes the idea of like being in the zone, for example, like I'm sure you're a great shooter. I'm sure you've had those games where it's like, I can't miss, I'm in the zone. Right. And then like, as a coach, like, we need to replicate this 365 days.
We want to stay in the zone. Right. Yeah.
But there's like specific games that you feel like, it wasn't just one person, multiple people were in, like, we felt it as a team was in the zone. And often I think that comes in like upsets, right?
Yeah.
So the game that stands out to me is, so I know Graham referenced, he had two ACCA national tournament championships. Also when he was the women's coach, they were at the ACCA tournament. They won the third place championship. And so that's where this story takes me. We're down. This is the year before we win NIAC. So we're still like not great. We're below 500. But it's spoiler, it's an invitational national tournament. It's like an NIT situation for our NCCA national tournament. So we go down, we get there, and our first game, we have a play-in game. We beat the host school. Then we play the top team in the country. And they're like, they've won 4 titles in a row or something like that. And so we play them. And they beat us by 40, but we're feeling like they're supposed to beat us by 60 or 70. And based on how our season has gone, but we're feeling pretty good. And, but that was the semifinal. So now we're playing for third. And it was kind of like, there were 3 teams at this tournament that were all like neck and neck, the team that smashed us, Arlington, from Texas. And then these 2 schools on the other side of the draw, from Oklahoma. And before the tournament starts, we're sitting at the awards banquet, and we, you know, you watch teams walk in, and this one team walks in, and we all like, are they in the right place? Like, the D1 tournament's not in Joplin, Missouri.
Yeah.
They were like specimens of basketball,
like super tall, like
big, like yeah, they look like D1 players. Yeah. They look like D1 players. I mean, like, sure, they're walking in heels, so they're like inches taller than reality. But like we aesthetically, we think we don't stand a chance, right? Mm-hmm. But we're not going to play them anyways. Sure enough, we make it to the semis. We lose. We're going for third place. This team loses a nail biter to this other team from Oklahoma, and so we're going to see them in the third place game. I'm going into the game thinking like anything can happen. Not realizing that I find out after that a lot of the players, I guess, like had no belief that anything good could come of this. But we go into the game, and you know, we've got a game plan, we've got a bit of a strategy here, and we're going toe to toe. I think first quarter we're it's 16-16, and we're starting to feel like we're in the zone. And at halftime, I think we're down 2 or 3, and after the third, we're up a few, and it just keeps going. And we average like 65 points a game. And this is the second best team outside of the Mayvilles that we are seeing all season long. Right. And we finish with 88 points. And my 5'1", if I'm generous, shooting guard from Glenboro, Manitoba, Joanne Schwartz, she puts up 22. She goes 6 for 8 from the 3-point line.
Wow.
It was the game where, like, everyone on the court was in the zone and everything was falling. It was amazing. That would be like, I don't know. What did you ask? Like highlight memory? I don't know.
Most memorable.
Most memorable.
Yeah. Kind of something that stands out. As
yeah. We win third.
But you guys won, right?
We won third. We won third at an American national tournament. They play our anthem. It's amazing. Like,
that's cool.
That was probably one of the most memorable moments. I mean, the winning the NIAC championship was obviously that was memorable because, you know, we won. And
of course.
And like, I want to say, like, winning a championship in my basketball career, I've got a Division II men's league, U of W league championship playing on Graham Bonner's team. Like, I got that picture up on my wall. That's it.
Yeah. So it's big time stuff for sure. We're getting close to the end, but I have to ask you before, you know, I wrap with some advice and we'll still get to that question, but you already kind of told us your funniest story, which is usually my next question, but I have to ask you about the Grinnell system. Because yes. I was told by Graham, and then we obviously talked a little bit on email before we got onto the podcast, and you guys ran that this year. Was it this year only, or you've been doing it for a little while?
This was year one. Okay. It will continue. It's not done.
What were the, I'm gonna ask some direct questions here. So like, what was something that surprised you about running the system that you didn't expect?
First of all, I had a fairly good understanding because during the pandemic, I really kind of like researched it. I stumbled into some curriculum. Like there's like, they wrote a textbook on it. Like, it's huge.
Wow.
Not Grinnell, but basically like the Grinnell system is a D3 men's program, an NAIA women's coach and I think a D3 men's coach adapted it, wrote a textbook basically on how to do it. And so I kind of stumbled into that. I studied the textbook. And so I had a pretty good idea. I've listened to podcasts of coaches who all across America who've run it, college, high school, and heard kind of their experiences. So there wasn't like a ton of things that overly surprised me, but I think they would be surprising to people. So for most people, they wouldn't know, the Grinnell system. I mean, if you've heard of Grinnell, you've heard of 136 point game. You might have heard this year they took all their shots from the 3-point, 111 threes they took in a game. Like they set records every year in new and impressive ways. So I had heard of them when I was playing. The game where the kids scored 136 points was against a team in our conference. And so like, I've talked to the coach, I've heard a little bit about that. That also ironically, the team that they took 111 threes against was also in our conference. It was like the week after we played them, they go and play Grinnell. So like I had heard about them, and then, Pierre gets hired. He's our men's coach, and they email him and invite us out. And so I tell him what he's getting himself into, like, well, let's do it. So we go down, and I got to go to Grinnell. I got to watch our guys play against the Grinnell system. Their women don't do it, but so I got to see it firsthand, and like it's something else.
Yeah.
I think you hate it or you love it. Most people hate it, is kind of the consensus, or they just like, I'm never going to see it. I'm never going to do it. So it doesn't really matter to me. Anyway, so like for people who don't understand, it's the idea of we want to outscore you. Like we're taking Phoenix Suns, we're taking Paul Westhead, run and gun to another level, and we're doing it and we're going to try to be as efficient as we can. So they're going to full court press for 40 minutes, which leads to we were giving 100% effort at all times. So we have to sub. And so they've figured it down to like the optimal window for performances, 30 to 90 seconds. Beyond 90 seconds, you're like, it's too long. It's like hockey, 2 minutes.
It's like hockey. Right? Yeah. I was going to say like hockey shifts. Yeah.
Yeah. And 30 seconds is a little short, but sometimes it's hard to get a whistle. So anyways, and you press and you run and you're trying to shoot in 12 seconds or less, and you're trying to get the ball back in 12 seconds or less. And anyways, but it takes a large roster. And so anyways, as I'm watching it, I was miserable to watch because I'm a Prov fan, and like, it was terrible. But during the pandemic, I'm learning about it, and I'm realizing, and so I start watching this NAIA team, this women's team that's running it, and it looks completely different. Like it looks like more of a normal game, but they're playing the system and they're punching above their weight class. And what stood out to me was the levels of enthusiasm that their team has. They're celebrating everything. They're out of their seats on every block, every steal, every made shot and threes. They're losing their minds. And that just looked like a lot of fun. And I felt there was two sides to it. And now I'm going to tell you why I did it. There's two sides to it. And then I'll come back to like the couple things that stood out, but I did it one because it looked so much fun. And everybody that I heard that did it said it was the most fun basketball that they had coached. And then on the other hand, I felt like we play in a really, really unique league. Like we touched on it. We're in the NIAC, we're in the MCAC, and we're in the NCCAA. And we, to win anything in the NCCAA, we have to beat teams that are NCAA D3 schools that, you know, playing their style, we're supposed to lose by 30 or 40. Like they're just far bigger schools than us. They're a couple thousand, worth 300. So like, how do you put yourself in a position where you could possibly upset a school like that? So you look at like March Madness and you're picking your brackets and you see what are all the things that stand out there. Like, hey, this team shoots a lot of threes. If they get hot, mm-hmm. they can break your bracket. This mm-hmm. this team full court presses. If they get a bunch of turnovers and cause chaos, they might break your bracket.
Yeah.
Like, well, the Grinnell system is taking all of these things. Plus they're at basketball, Canada basketball, they're teaching you, we want to be disruptive. Well, like pressing, that's disruptive. In the half court, we keep pressing. That's disruptive. They want you to be deceptive. So offensively, like, how can you be different? So you're a little less scoutable, mm-hmm. while playing mm-hmm. a little bit more free, playing quicker, all of these things. So it just kind of all kind of came together. And it seemed like if we want to be able to upset somebody, mm-hmm. we need to do something that gives us enough opportunity that we could upset somebody. And that was me kind of feeling like, I don't want to settle for being third in our region. I would rather, you know, hey, maybe we lose in the first round, we shoot bad, but the mm-hmm. next year we go back and we win the whole thing. Mm-hmm. I want to give myself a chance to win. I don't want to just, you know, show up and be okay placing, right? So those were kind of the reasons. And the things that surprised me a little bit were things like, so you've got your key players who you're expecting, their minutes are getting cut, their stats are going to go down. All of my key player, like key offensive, you know, mm-hmm. leading stats getters in the rankings, they exceeded or at minimum stayed the same playing this way.
Interesting.
They took, my goodness, like some of my shooters took way more shots than they would normally take. So mm-hmm. yeah, maybe their percentages might be a little bit lower, but their totals higher or even. Mm. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure you've got more questions about it.
No, I know it's an interesting system. So, because again, just for the sake of time, like we try to keep these. I'm definitely want to have a bunch of questions, but like say for the sake of just, you know, making sure people understand what the Grinnell system is. If you had to summarize it, just very quickly, talk about the subbing pattern. You already talked about already like shooting in 12 seconds, turn the ball over in 12 seconds. Shoot obviously a lot of higher percentage shots or shots worth more. So that's why I love a lot of threes that go up. Talk about the subbing, because that's the only thing you didn't really touch on. Yeah. It's a quick pattern, but like, is it like lines? It's like, hey, we have this 5-5-5-5. Like you, mm-hmm. I would imagine that this is harder to coach in a sense that you're more like getting people in, or they just know already. Like mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah. There's different, I won't talk a lot about line construction. There's ways of going about line construction, but as far as like subbing patterns, basically we have a coach who is charting every shift, and they have a stopwatch because it's just too hard to do the math on the fly of the clock.
Yeah.
And the idea is that they want to send the next five after 30 seconds of play to the table.
Interesting.
So they're running every 30 seconds. They're documenting like in out scores. So we know plus minus of lines. We want to know like line shift length. So we have the data of like, hey, this line was -4. Well, they were over 2 minutes. Why? Well, because they're tired, they're giving up layups. Or, you know, this line only, it was neutral. Well, they were only out 30 seconds and nobody made a shot. Like, so we can get some of that data afterwards. But yeah, we have a coach that sits between the two lines on the bench, and they're managing it. And then like I'll audible things that as I'm standing there, if I'm like, no, I want that line out a couple seconds longer, I'll send them back maybe. Or like this is going disastrous. And I break one of the cardinal rules in coaching the system, and I'm like, subs, and I get the next group. and I reference cardinal rule, like the system is about creating positive encouragement. We're trying to get players to be in the zone more often, and coaches kind of across the board, when players start making mistakes, missing shots, taking bad looks, they get subbed out. When players get into foul trouble, they get subbed out. Well, the system says, one, we're trying to motivate kids in the game. Like in practice, we can break stuff down and be a little bit more critical, but in the game we need positive energy. So we're not subbing people out for making mistakes.
Got it.
And we're not subbing people out for fouls. And I did it one time this year, and I won't say when, but I did it one time this year where I broke that rule, and I regret it because our offense went dry and we lost a big game. And you don't know, but you don't know what you don't know. And so when coaches are taking players out in the first half, because they've got three fouls, you don't know if that kid was going to foul out.
You have no idea.
And that kid, if you're expecting them to come in late in the fourth quarter, they're cold.
Mm-hmm.
But the system says, I would rather risk what I don't know, leave them in the game and hope for them to be able to adapt to what's being called. And they do. I've had only a couple kids foul out and it's been late in the game. And I had my captain have four fouls in the first quarter one game. And she made it till the 8 minute mark in the fourth quarter. Like,
wow.
It's a different way of doing things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, it's interesting. You said you're going to keep it, right? Like it's staying.
Yeah. When I decided that I was going to do it, one, people asked me like, what's your backup plan if it sucks here during the year? Like, are you going to change at Christmas or something? I'm like, if you have a plan B, you're going to take it. You can't have a plan B. And then like, well, how about after year one? And like, there's no way that I could see what this can do in one season. Yeah,
you definitely can't. And
what I've seen is like my recruiting now, I'm the only one doing this. I don't know if anyone else in Canada is doing this, or at least not known. When I'm recruiting kids now, I'm recruiting kids who want to play this way. And the more I get kids who want to come and play this way, the more buy-in we have to playing this way, the more success we'll have. And I said we were talking about at the beginning, like nobody's heard of Providence.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if we do something that's outside the box and I talk about it on Basketball Manitoba podcast and people pay attention, all of a sudden, maybe more people are going to hear about Providence. They're going to know about us. And I'll be honest, I have a kid right now who's looking at a couple of schools and they're like, the school she's looking at, one of them just won CCA Nationals. And she's looking at us and she's looking here because she wants to play this way. So it changes the game for me a lot playing this way.
I'll be doing it
for a little bit.
No, I love it. I love it. I mean, again, I've like you, I heard about the Grinnell system long time ago, saw the, you know, ESPN, they did a little story and you're like, what the heck is going on here? But again, I think it, you said some people don't like it because it might fly in the face of like, you know, what people would consider, you know, whatever it is. But the interesting thing is it is a system, right? That's why it's called the Grinnell system. Playing within the rules, you can do whatever you want. And there's a very systematic approach to playing basketball, right? Versus the system that most people use, which is, you know, hey, I gotta keep this person in or they get some fouls, take them off. Like everyone else, whether they know it or not, are actually following a pretty generic system. It's why when a player does get a lot of fouls, they're like, okay, we have to take them out. That's a system. Like that's what most people do. And someone set that standard. Right. Mm-hmm. So no, I love it. I wish you obviously success in it. And hopefully what will happen in the next couple of years is there'll be a story like, what's this, you know, this team from Manitoba running this, you know, you guys put up like 150 on somebody or something crazy happens. So,
yeah.
We got to wrap soon though. It's been, we're getting close to, I think we're just over an hour now, which is pretty much the norm, but one more question before we go. And so, you know, we probably talked about this in so many, you know, just kind of listening to the story, you could, you know, there's messages within the story and lessons within the story, but I like to ask the question directly as a last question. So I like to frame it this way. So you're standing in a room with a bunch of young coaches, right? They're all, you know, whether like say you're at the Basque Manitoba clinic or you're at, I don't know if Prov does something like this, but just imagine you're standing there. You've now been coaching for 12 years. We talked about where you started coaching and kind of what you've learned along the way. So you now have some knowledge and some experience to pass on to the next generation of coaches. So someone, you know, lifts their hand up and they say, Joel, you know, like I'm a new coach. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm coaching this team. And they're like, what should I do? And obviously you can't tell them everything. So you need to have them walk out of there with something that they can use to take forward and go on their own journey of learning. What would you tell that person?
Yeah, I guess ultimately it's what I would tell myself looking back. There's so many ways of going about things to think that there's only one way and you have to search for this one way. Mm. And that all these successful people out there have figured out this one way of doing things. You're setting yourself up to fail, because you'll realize that everybody does things uniquely different. And there's so many ways of being successful. And I think if you can kind of create what your values are, and you can lay those out, and then you can kind of start from that point, build something from your value system. And if you can get kids to buy into what you're doing, you'll find successes, and those successes may be wins. Mm-hmm. But I think you'll see that, like I did in the end, when we did win, the win itself was far less important to me than the journey building what we had and getting to that point. Mm-hmm. And I think what I came across this year, there's a quote, I'll just share the quote, because I think it changed the way that I think about coaching basketball. It's the road not taken by Robert Frost. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And to me, that kind of is what we're doing now. And mm-hmm. and I think if people could take that approach and not feel like they need to replicate what somebody else is doing, I think they'll have a lot more self-confidence, and that'll probably lead to more success.
Mm-hmm. Well said, man. Well said. I love it. It's a great way to wrap it up. When we came on, I wasn't sure if you were going to be a storyteller, and you are my friend, a storyteller. So I love it. It was perfect. It's perfect. Like I've had a few people who are not storytellers, a bunch who are, like yourself. And those are my favorite ones, because I actually just get to sit and listen. And, you know, I just asked, hey, poke the bear a little bit. Tell me this question. Then you'll just go on a thing. So it was great. Like, you know, I enjoyed myself a lot with this. And, I think the Grinnell system is like the perfect system for Prov, because like we kind of started the podcast on that thing of being like, look, most people don't know where Prov is, right? Like, yeah. Even if they do, they don't know it's in Otterburn. They don't physically know where it is. They might have heard of it. Like, where's Otterburn? I have no idea where Otterburn was either. And so I think that's one of those things that you can, you know, set yourself apart from the crowd. And again, Prov is already has a reputation of being, once some people get into the door there, it's a special place for people. And I think, you know, this system and some of the values and everything that you've kind of established is going to make that even more of a special place for people. So it was cool to hear, and I appreciate you for taking the time to talk and share your story.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Darcy. Honestly, this was, I never thought that I would be sitting here, with the names of people that you're interviewing. I mean, yourself, like to be asked to be interviewed and on your podcast is truly a real honor, and I appreciate it a lot. Thank you.
Absolutely. All right, man, take care.
You too.
All right.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Please like, subscribe, follow, and share this series, and reach out to us with your comments on the show. Thanks again for joining us.